We are going to stretch a little bit because we've been sitting and I've been sitting and I like to move a bit. So I know this is terribly innovative for this hall, but we can manage, I promise. It won't be too scary. So if you would, you can do this sitting if you'd prefer, but otherwise, please stand. And as with everything in life, only do things that feel right for your body. We're not going to do anything terribly aerobic or athletic or gymnastic. But if you have a shoulder replacement, you know, or an injury like I do, and you know you can't move it in a certain way, make an adjustment. Don't just do it because I'm telling you to. Wouldn't that be nice, though, if I could just say, do everything I'm telling you to do and just do it. There are people like that in this world that we happen to elect. Okay. So we're going to, again, this should all be really easy on the body. So if you, and we'll only go for an hour and a half, a couple of minutes. If you'd let your feet be parallel to each other, and if you can stand on the floor rather than on a zabuton, that would be great. Very closed in here. Okay. And we'll start really easily by rolling the shoulders up and back. And as you do that, without any undue effort, just feel your breathing as well. So you breathe with the movement in your own way. Good, looks beautiful. So fun to see a sea of shoulders rolling. And then the other way, it's really pretty from up here. Choreography. Keep feeling your breath and feel the body moving as you do the movement. And then we're going to reach the arms right out in front of us. And as you do that, sometimes we forget to actually feel the fingers. So let some energy come into those fingers. Extend the fingers and the shoulders. And let those arms float all the way up. But keep feeling the feet on the floor. Lovely. And then reach those arms. Nice. There you go. And then soften the shoulders and let it all soften. And then reach one more time. And soften the shoulders. And then if it's available to you, interlace the fingers, turn the palms over. And if that's too hard on your shoulders, you can keep those hands separate from each other and press the palms to the ceiling. And then just very gently look up and breathe in and reach, 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 reach. And as we release the arms and let them fall, we're going to go, ha. Yes, because as we use the voice, it helps the body relax. The heads, you're going to take the stance a little bit wider. Let the chin fall to the chest. Head is really heavy. It's one of the heaviest parts of the body. And then keeping the knees slightly bent, let the weight of the head curl the spine over. Can we keep softening the head? Let the shoulders be heavy, the arms be heavy. Just go as far as you feel comfortable. You're hinging from the pelvis. And then hanging there, let it all lengthen and release and relax. Shake the head like you're nodding it yes. Shake the head like you're shaking it no. Shake out the shoulders a little bit. And then by pressing the feet into the floor, we root to rise. We press the feet into the floor and start rolling up that spine one vertebra at a time. Take your time. Feel the movement as you do it. Nice. And let the arms come. Beautiful. Up again. Interlace the fingers again. Press the palms to the ceiling if you can. Look up. Breathe in and ha. And the out-breath, we let it release. Good. And then just little where you are, because we're in a bit of tight quarters. We're going to swing from one side to the other. The knees are soft. Be careful that you're not locking your knees. You want the knees to be soft, the arms to swing. And then every once in a while, we're just going to go, ha. 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 Let it come from the belly. Ha. Huh. Huh. And coming to center, knees are soft, you're going to jiggle it out. You're going to shake things out and go, get as much shaking as you can. Let it all that aggravation and agony and politics and human relationships. And coming to a stillness, knees are soft, let your eyes close, feel the breath. Feel whatever energy has been generated in the body. The eyes open gently. And then move the mouth around. And you want to pucker the mouth and open it wide and spread it out. Try and get the face all contorted in and then spread out long. And you have to stick out your tongue as well. It goes like this. This is what you do if you study theater. Shake out the hands, shoulders, hips. Get all shaken out. And come to a stillness. And then gently let your eyes open and take your seat. Thank you. If anyone's in the back and want to come up, there are a few seats up here in the front row. There are about three. If you have an empty seat next to you, if you'd raise your hand, just in the event, if you're sitting in the back and you want to come up closer, you're welcome to. No one wants to move. Not moving. I want to move, but I'm not going to. I've become really interested lately in my own practice in what they call in both Pali and Sanskrit a term called avijja or avidya. And it means ignorance. And I've been watching through really intensive practice and just daily life, the way ignorance or delusion arises so readily in my mind and conditions the way I see reality. What I love about this term in part is that the actual etymology of the word. So avidya means the lack of awareness. Awe is without, right? It precedes, it's a, what do they call that when there's a letter that precedes a whole word? Like ex machina or ex partner, ex spouse. there's a term for that. Prefix, is that right? Thank you. So awe means without, lack of, non-existing. And then vidya or avijja, depending on if it's Sanskrit or Pali, means awareness or clarity. So, ignorance arises from this lack of awareness, and by dropping the ignorance or getting the awareness very clear, the ignorance falls away, and what we're left with is clear awareness or clear seeing. So that will really be the topic of my talk tonight, my reflection. And it's something I invite you to reflect upon as well in your life in the days to come. It's very helpful. And perhaps right now one of the most important practices is to become aware of our ignorance. We tend to become aware of other people's ignorance. That's one of our very favorite activities. But seeing our own, we become less aware of the ignorance of people who agree with us about our own ignorance. And then even less aware of our own. It's hard to see. It's really hard to see for the most part. So the moments when the ignorance falls away and clarity arises, or where we see our own delusion, are incredibly important in the life of a, I was going to say a life of the person who has a spiritual practice, but I think the life of anybody, if they call themselves practitioners or not. So we're going to back up a little bit and then move forward and come to this. When we practice, one of the most important things to do at the very beginning of any period of practice, whether it be a Monday night or when you're at home sitting on your own in the morning, if you happen to do that, or evening or afternoon or on retreat, is to remind ourselves or reflect upon or become clear about why we practice. Why are we doing it? Because when we practice, a lot of doubt can arise in the mind and take us away from our practice. The question will arise as you're sitting there quietly, especially for days on end, why am I doing this? Right? My back hurts, my knee hurts, this is getting really boring, I'm really hungry, what's for dinner? Why am I, anybody have that experience of a little bit of doubt arising in your mind? Not many of you. That's impressive. Raise, let me see. Yeah. And they say that doubt is one of the hindrances when we practice. So when we can remind ourselves, like, why are we doing this? It can help stabilize us in our practice and in our commitment to practice, which is also really important to have that. What Anam Tupten was talking about, it is a burning desire to wake up. And in these days, when the times feel to us to be so troubled, although I imagine times are often troubled, this troubling times is not new to humanity, to the human species. Troubling times are not infrequent. But in our lives, this can seem to many of us like a particularly troubling time. That this commitment to clarity of mind, to awareness, to wake up, is particularly important. And many of us might feel that. So why do we do it? There are lots of different ways to answer it, but this is a really beautiful answer that I came across in my practice over the years that I'm fond of. So one of the teachings, and you know, there are many, many Buddhist teachings, and I recommend if you're interested to study with teachers, find ways of understanding your practice that appeal to you, because they're people could explain this or could come up with this answer in different ways. And I find this one really helpful. There are two motivations or intentions for practice. Nice to whittle it down to two, isn't it? There's really one. There's really one. And that's to end our suffering. Right? That's why we're here. If we really tell the truth and look honestly, that's why we're here. We're here because we're not having that great a time of it. And we'd like to have a little more ease and peace and equanimity and love, compassion. Because when we don't have those experiences or qualities of mind, we suffer. And so there's really just one reason to be here. So then we're going to go to the two reasons, because it's nice to have more than one. Because just ending our suffering, it just gets a little boring. So there are two intentions for practice. And one intention is to abandon, and the other is to adopt. Doesn't that help? It's so clear and simple. We want to abandon something and we want to adopt something. So what do we want to abandon? In the Buddhist teachings, we want to abandon what we call the three root poisons of greed, hatred, and aversion. Aversion is hatred. I'm sorry. Of greed, ignorance, and aversion, or hatred. And the Pali word, one of them for greed is tanha, clinging. So we can think of greed as wanting what we don't have, which we feel pretty commonly in one way or another, right? Wanting what we don't have. Right now you might want something that you don't have, I would even hypothesize. And not wanting what we do have. Maybe we want a different body. Maybe we don't want to be the age that we are. Maybe we want to live in a different house. Maybe we want a different sofa. Maybe we want a different partner. Or a different backyard. Or a different career, right? We want something that we don't have, and we don't want something that we do have. So that's really greed or an aversion. We also suffer a great deal from attachment or clinging. Something happens, there's a loss. I just lost a very dear friend in December. And grief arises. We don't want our friends to die. We don't want our bodies to die. We're attached to our friends, to our own life, to our pets, to our family, and really attached to our ideas about what's right and what's wrong and how the world should be run. So we want to abandon greed, hatred, and delusion. And we want to adopt wisdom and compassion. When we adopt wisdom, compassion arises naturally. That's another really interesting thing to investigate. We won't go into that a lot tonight, but I recommend that investigation. Like, we've all had experiences of the heart softening and opening when it's been closed. And it's a moment of grace. And we see the whole world with a loving heart, even the people we dislike. Right? Suddenly these people we dislike, we see something about them, their conditioning, their habits of mind, their own suffering, and we soften. And we start to fall in love with the whole world. Anyone had that experience for a moment? And that arises from wisdom or grace. That when we see the world with wisdom, compassion and love and kindness arise. And along with that, happiness arises because we prefer being loving and kind. It's our nature. So the good news is that now we know why we're here. And the teaching goes, this is another of my favorite parts of this teaching, there are a lot, is that our true nature or our Buddha nature is naturally, innately loving, kind, compassionate, peaceful. And what gets in the way of experiencing that are these obfuscations in the mind. They cloud our perception of ourselves in the world. Any form of self-loathing is a delusion. And we see the world so much from this state of conditioning, of obfuscation. And so our own true nature is not available to us. And that's why we're here, to sort of peel away the delusions and be able then to rest in our own true nature. And they say that awakening, we could spend weeks here talking about, well, what does that even mean? We use that term awakening like we all understand, right? Awakening, well, I don't know what that means. But it's convenient for now that awakening, and we can call it awakening to this true nature, is the deepest form of relaxation. The Tibetans call it alala. You can use that for your password. Alala. And then if you forget, you know, they have those like clues. You have to have clues to remind yourself, favorite dog. Then you forget what the clue is. You can just remind yourself to relax in order to remember it, and then you'll remember it. Ah, la, la. Nobody's writing that down as a note. All right, so that... the good news is when we're able to relax deeply enough, really deeply, it's like on a cellular level, even tinier than that molecular level, then our true nature reveals itself. It doesn't come from effort. It comes from letting go. Anyone taste that a little bit? You soften enough, right? The softening, and then this loving heart can actually arise. So one of the core delusions that in this whole philosophy, spiritual philosophy of Buddhism, is probably the core delusion, is the delusion of separate self. And anatta is the term for the absence of a self, that non-self, the complete absence of this sense of I'm a separate being. This is a very esoteric teaching in a lot of ways. And I'm going to talk about the esoteric level just a little bit because it's so important. And then we're going to go to the less complex or hard to grasp part of it. Because in reality, most of the people I know and most of the beings I know, like my dogs, perceive themselves as pretty separate. If I pet one dog, the other will come running because her separate self is not being pet the way the other dog's separate self is being pet. So this conditioning around seeing ourselves as separate is not unique to humans. There's a very strong feeling, perception, orientation, conditioning, sensibility that we're separate. And in many ways, we are. But in other ways, we aren't. And there can be moments from deep practice or spontaneous awakening or an LSD trip or they say, here's other times you can taste it. In case you don't want to go into intensive practice or take LSD, you can. There are four opportunities for this moment of awakening in a lifetime. One is when you sneeze. One is when you have an orgasm. One is right before you fall asleep. The other is right before you die. And the common characteristics are that something lets go. and you experience yourself is this vast, what we might call consciousness or awareness. And you go, oh, that's me. That's me. And it feels like you've come home to who you really are. And it's so familiar. It doesn't feel hard to grasp or abstract. My teacher in India, Punjaji, would say something like this. He said, the path's so narrow that two cannot exist. You just exist as one. In this consciousness that is the consciousness that is trees, right? They're conscious. Or grasses, or animals, or even clouds, they say, and rocks, stones, is not separate from us. We are all of that. I am that. And there's a great relief that occurs when we feel that. And what happens is when we start to feel separate, this separate identity, they call it a severance from the ground of being. We start to suffer. Because there's this longing to feel more deeply connected and more at ease. We suffer because we feel severed from the ground of being. And then they say when we die, and I don't, who knows? I invite you to not take anything I say as true. Please don't. Investigate for yourself. Great danger arises when we take other people's philosophizing as true. So investigate for yourself. See what feels right. So a great deal of our suffering arises from this sense of separation. And one of the teachings I've taken on right now to kind of hold in a daily way is this teaching around what they call becoming. That in order to be a separate self, we have to become that separate self. And it's the first in this, in the, have you all seen the Tibetan tanka? That's the wheel of suffering, and there are all kinds of points and people and teachings on it. So that's a great thing to study if you're interested, because it's the links of how suffering occurs in a human life, in multiple human lives, this wheel of how it all hooks together. And the first link is this impulse that we have to become someone. And I've been watching that in the last while, particularly the last few days, of when I'm becoming someone. And I can feel it. Sometimes someone will say something, and my first impulse will be to disagree with them. So I will say something. And part of me is going, I don't even know if I believe what I'm saying right now, but I have to be somebody. Anybody know that feeling? Like we suddenly have opinions about things, and I've really been watching that in myself. Someone even asked me a question right after the retreat. She said, well, I don't remember the question, but well, what do you think about this experience? So I had a lot of permission to be an authority, and I took it. And I saw myself with this becoming, arising. And I could feel this subtle suffering of that. Right? This subtle. Because as soon as you become somebody, you lose touch with what's actually true. And so I stopped myself and I said, I don't know. But maybe it could be like this. right? And the whole ego starts to soften and fall away, and it's so much more comfortable. The suffering of separation and the suffering of having to be somebody and the suffering of becoming. I want to talk to you about a couple of experiences I had recently that were really informative around this delusion. These are watching the mind in the delusion of mind is really interesting. I really invite you to do it. I don't think there's anything more important right now because our delusions are running the world. Not just other people's delusions, ours. And it's time we took responsibility for our own ignorance. Because when we act out of ignorance, no matter how morally motivated, we will create more ignorance. We cannot change the world with the same mind that created the problems. It won't work, unfortunately. So the work we have right now for ourselves is not easy work. It is rigorous, and it is extraordinarily important. So a few experiences I had. I was going with a friend to a restaurant in San Rafael, and I'd heard this restaurant was really good. It's a fusion Latin restaurant, La Vire, I think it's called. Now, I'd been there many years ago, and that restaurant has like come and gone through many different lifetimes, and it never really been successful. And I said to my friend, oh, you know, it's going to be empty, and I don't know if the food's any good, but no one's ever there. And I was completely convinced of my highly informed opinion, having been there once before. And we opened the door, and that place was like teeming with people. And there were like plants everywhere and music, and it was teeming with people. We barely got a table. And I saw, I had so believed myself. I had believed my own opinion. Not a moment of doubt had entered my mind about what I thought about that restaurant. And I was completely wrong. And it was, I went, Nina, remember that. Because that's what you're doing all the time. And that is a form of suffering. Not that I was wrong. I was deluded. I have this experience at the retreat. What I like to tell people, because I do this myself, is that they're the Buddhist suttas and the Dhammapada, and they're the, you know, Hindu and Sanskrit teachings, and there's the Bible and the Old Testament and the Torah and the Quran. There are these known religious texts that we identify as religious and spiritual texts, but we each have our own. We each have experiences in our lives that are our spiritual teachings, and we could each write our own book. Oh, this is the teaching I got from my grandmother. This is the teaching I got from my mother. This is the teaching I got around food. This is the teaching that I got on retreat. This is the teaching I got by thinking the restaurant was full when it was empty. So collect your own teachings. That is what will inform you more than anything you read or anything you hear, no matter how great the teacher. So I went on this retreat, and we had the option of staying in a cabin. The cabins looked quite lovely, but they were not inexpensive. Or staying in a teepee, a grand teepee, or staying in the lesser teepees, or bringing our own tent. And I looked at the options and the pricing of the options, and I thought, well, I have a tent. I like my tent. I haven't been in my tent for quite a while. I should just be in my tent. I like my tent. I think I like my tent. I hope my tent has all its parts. I hope I remember how to put the tent up. And then I didn't register for a long time because I thought, well, maybe I shouldn't live in a tent. Maybe I should just spend the extra money, even though my performance artist income is somewhat limited, and I'll just spend a few $100 more and be, you know, in the high rent district. It's a retreat. I should treat myself well. And now that, no, you should really be in your tent. You like your tent. Well, maybe you could be in a teepee, kind of middle ground. I thought, well, I don't know if my teepee is any better than the tent. Not mine, the teepee. And then I looked at the pictures of the teepees and the cabins. And I thought about how less expensive it is if you have a person that you're sharing the price with and how they discriminate against single people. And then I finally just said, I'm staying in my tent. And before the retreat, I got my tent out. I went to REI and got a special, you know, they have thicker thermarests now that supposedly self-inflate, but not really. That's like, talk about delusion. And then I got there, and there were a lot of very kind volunteers, but it wasn't entirely clear where I was to put my tent up. So I wandered about and found a place under these tall redwood trees. Tall. They're really tall. I got some help putting up my tent from Jack, who happened to walk by, and I nabbed him. And then I stayed in my tent. I really did like my tent. My tent has these skylights, so you can lie in your tent and look at the sky at night, which I knew in a cabin you couldn't do. But then, on day 3, I wandered around the property, and I saw what the high-rent district looked like. And I immediately went into my thing. Oh, if only I had a bit more money in my career, and how come, and the people, and why didn't they tell me, and maybe I should move my tent, but I don't want to pack up the tent and then get Jack to help me again. It's a silent retreat. I have to do it by myself. Schlep the tent to a whole other place and roll up the thermarest. Try rolling up a thermarest. They're just really hard. So I decided to stay where I was in my tent under the tall redwoods. And I came home one night . I just want to clarify, there's this thing about, you know, the part of town, the other side of the tracks. It's almost mythological. That thing that's just out of reach that other people have, that you want, that creates so much suffering on one level or another, a good deal of our lives. So I was walking home to my tent, and I realized I had put my tent up around where all the teepees were, these little, not tall, not too tall teepees, and they were all glowing from within. And it was absolutely exquisite. And I knew I would never have seen that had I been in one of those cabins. And had I been in one of those cabins or put my tent up in the high rent district where I could have put it up, I'd be in this little tent with these buildings all around me that weren't glowing from within. They would have had electricity. I realized that I was in the most perfect place I could possibly be. In my tent, with the little teepee people. It was absolutely perfect. And my delusion fell away, because I didn't really want what I thought I wanted. I wanted to be in my tent on my thick thermarest, looking through the netting at the stars at night. And I felt so badly for all the people who couldn't be in tents. Either because they didn't know, or because some people are older. And I thought, you know, how long can I be in a tent? My knees are going to go. This is so lucky. I am so lucky right now. But there were, and that the ignorance fell away, the conditioning and the delusion. And I thought, boy, I'm looking at my life like that a lot of the time. And it clouds the mind. And it keeps us from seeing what's true, and it keeps us suffering. I've been watching in much deeper ways than teepee land my ignorance. It's very humbling. And I invite you to go on that journey. And the thing is, it's not our fault. We are conditioned in many ways. We're conditioned, they say, I got this teaching years ago from Thich Nhat Hanh. In Buddhist, what we might call psychology, let's call it that for now. It's a little more complex than that, but we'll use that term. The unconscious or the subconscious is called the alaya vijnaya. And it's this ground of being where seeds or bijas are planted that then grow into what we might call architectural formations that determine how we experience ourselves in the world. Does that make some sense? So some of the seeds are planted in our own lifetime, like from how we're treated in early childhood around attachment. If we're loved or if we're abused, those become formations internally that determine how we view the world. Some are planted intergenerationally. Like if there's all this research now on epigenetics, if there's trauma that our parents and grandparents experience, that is planted in our subconscious and starts to determine the way we experience the world. Some comes from the time we're born, in the culture we're born into, and the religion we're born into. And these are all determining how we experience the world. And so our delusions that come from our conditioning aren't our fault. Anand Tupten gave me this teaching months ago. He said that every person has a core neurosis, a core delusion, every single person. Isn't that a relief? You're not the only one. Or maybe it's not a relief that you actually have one. But he says they're innocent. So those faults we see in each other, it's not really people's fault. It comes from their conditioning. And when we start to hold that view, so much compassion and love can arise. When we have a separate self that arises from this impulse to become, we start to see the whole world from what they call this view of deep self-centeredness. And part of what awakening is we lift off into this transcendence. It's like going up in a hot air balloon, and you start to see the whole landscape and all the players in it from this completely different point of view. And that's really what we're here to do. Can we transcend this self-identity and start to see the world and the universe from this other point of view? And when that self-centeredness falls away, so much more compassion and kindness can arise. So I'm going to finish with this one story that I heard many years ago. And I wanted to call Jack today to get this right. It was taught here before any of these halls were built, and when they had who used to come when we sat in the big trailer over there? And so maybe you heard this teacher. It was from a Palestinian man who lived in the canal, and unfortunately he's passed away since. He was a friend of Jack's and a very profound spiritual teacher who was, you know, had escaped as a had very difficult conditions in the Mideast and was living here in the canal working as a janitor or something now, but he was a highly educated, highly spiritually developed teacher. And he taught one night, and he told this story that, again, I hope I have this pretty right. You'll get the point. It's another of these teachings I hold in my heart as part of my personal scriptures. He was a Palestinian activist, a very gentle being, and he was arrested by the Israeli police and put in a jail in Israel. The jail was maintained in part by a Russian Jew who had migrated from Russia. And he was the guard of the jail. And the Palestinian man was not treated particularly kindly by the guard, nor were any of the prisoners. And the Russian guard was also not treated very kindly by the prisoners, as these things happen in these institutions where people are imprisoned. A lot of suffering. The cell that this man was in had a little window onto the courtyard where they would get to exercise once a day, and he would look out the window through the bars and he saw a pigeon. And he realized it was the same pigeon that would come. They began to recognize this pigeon. So even though he got very little food, he decided each day to give some of his food to the pigeon. And so the pigeon kept coming, and they got to know each other. And he kept offering this food to the pigeon, and he could recognize the voice of the pigeon, the footsteps of the pigeon, the flutter of the wings of the pigeon, and he had this friend. And that was partly what kept his soul alive, this bonding with this pigeon. And I don't know if you've looked at pigeons lately, but when the sun hits their neck feathers, they're all purple and shimmering. Their coloring is very, very beautiful and can be very uplifting to see that beauty. The Russian guard noticed that he was feeding the pigeon. He decided to feed the pigeon too. So he took a little of his food and fed the pigeon in the yard. And it became the sort of pet of these two men who really didn't like each other at all. A lot of hatred between them and a lot of mean treatment. Something happened to the pigeon, and this is the part I can't remember. I think the pigeon got wounded or got stepped on. And the pigeon died. And this animal that had become the focus of love, day to day, and friendship, and heart softening for the Palestinian man, was now gone, and he grieved very deeply. And when grief like that arises, it's not just for the pigeon, of course, but all the grief of loss. And the Russian guard, his enemy, who he was sure would taunt him, came to the door of the cell through the bars and looked in. And he started to weep, because he had lost the pigeon too. And they put their hands through the bar, and they held hands, and they wept together. They became friends, and the Palestinian man heard the story of the youth of this Russian Jew and all the abuse he had suffered. I don't remember the details, but you can imagine. And he realized that this behavior, this misbehavior of the guard, this cruelty, had arisen from the cruelty he had experienced. Because that's what happens. And the Russian guard began to hear the stories of the Palestinian man and the cruelty and abuse he had experienced. And they really became friends. That is the way the world is going to change. When we act out of our delusion, we create more ignorance. It is important now that we take the time to practice, to soften the heart, to allow our delusions to be recognized and fall away, so that when we act, we can act from as much clarity as we are possibly capable of. Thich Nhat Hanh led a retreat many years ago for activists in Ojai. We arrived at the retreat. These are activists from all over the country who came to study with this great activist Buddhist teacher. We got there. He didn't come for the first 3 days. It was a 10-day retreat. So we were pretty eager for him to show up because we were activists. not the most relaxed people in the world. And the world was in bad shape even then and needed our help. And we were the ones that were going to do it. Oh, so he came, he sat the first morning with us. We were so happy to see him. He'd flown in from France. And then he opened his eyes after the meditation and he said, "Do nothing today. Don't even meditate." We got to meditate 3 times a day for 20 minutes each. Some of us asked, could we meditate a little longer? No. We could have tea, we had our meals, we were in silence, but we couldn't do anything. All right, so a day went by, we didn't do anything, we were activists, we were, you know, wanting to be active. We sat down the next day ready to get going here on our training. He sat, bell rang after the meditation, he felt the energy in the room, or outside under the big oak tree, big live oak tree. Do nothing. Day two. We didn't have that much time with him. Now day two, we did nothing. Day three. Meditate. Bell rings. He feels the energy in the room. Do nothing. People were getting pissed now. You know, they're going to they start writing their evaluations. The aversion was arising, judgment. And I remember that afternoon going back to where I was camping and sitting on a hillside, and across the way were these California grassy hills that do actually go golden. I used to think golden was a big lie. People didn't want to say dry, dead grass. But the light was hitting the grasses and they actually were golden. They were reflecting the light, right? And I was sitting there now having done nothing for days and the wind was moving through the grasses and they were swaying in the wind and it was absolutely stunningly captivating. Now that had been going on every day and I hadn't seen it. I hadn't seen anything. Because my mind was obfuscated. And when that falls away, the world shines at you and shows itself to you, and the heart opens. Fourth day, we meditated, bell rang, and he said, "Okay, I'm going to give you teachings now, because now you can hear them. Thank you for listening. I invite you to investigate your delusions. Cherish the heart when it opens. And practice with a burning desire because we need it now from everyone." We're going to end with a little bit of chanting. You've had your practice. So now when you chant Om Ahum, you can chant really loud. And we're going to send that chant of loving kindness to all beings everywhere in the whole universe. May all beings be free of suffering. May all beings be happy. May all beings be safe in this world. May all beings find peace, including ourselves. You can chant really loud if you want. Om Ahum. Om Ahum. Let's take a moment to sit in silence as we end our evening together. Inviting the heart to be soft, the mind relaxed. As we dedicate the efforts of our evening to our own well-being, to one another's well-being, to the well-being of all beings everywhere, in all directions, in all realms, and throughout all time. I have a couple of announcements before we leave, which self-expression is one of the most important ways we can reach some calm and equanimity inside of ourselves. I'm teaching a day-long next Saturday called Joyful Awakening, which will include meditation, chanting, and some self-expressive practices here in Fairfax. You're welcome to come. I'm teaching a weekend up at the Yuba River on the eve of the meteor showers, the peak of the Perseids, where we will meditate and go to the river during the day and do practices on the river. And then at night, lay back and watch the meteors. It's a new moon this year, so they're supposed to be quite spectacular. And here at Spirit Rock, I'm part of a team of teachers teaching the creativity retreat in September. There's a writing track and a painting track and a self-expression track. That's mine. And so there's still room in that track. If you're interested, please come. Thank you for your attention tonight. It was a privilege to be with you.